we're in election mode because this morning, guess what? It's the turn of the TUV leader, Jim Allister, to spell out his policies to us today. The TUV, the real alternative. Enough is enough, says Mr. Allister on the front of his manifesto. What does that mean, Jim? Enough is enough.
Well, enough of the failure to give the people of Northern Ireland the basic democratic rights to change their government, even have an opposition. Enough of the constant pandering to Sinn Féin. Enough of the racking up of impossible debt by Stormont to the tune now of £1.8 billion. Enough of the parties of failure which have made Stormont a byword for catastrophic failure in terms of government.
Enough
so
of the,
lots to say enough of enough about.
Enough of the grumpy old Jim Allister that whinges and gurns and snipes from the side.
Certainly not enough of the articulate, effective voice of opposition that manages to be heard despite the contrivances of Stormont to deny opposition. And I think more and more I meet on the doorsteps people with whom that resonates and who are appreciative that TUV makes that stand and makes that effort. And people who are despairing, as I am, that if there is the opportunity of a hung parliament, that none of the other parties are putting a demand to the for the democratising of Stormont.
You've no punch. The TUV, you say in your manifesto, is the insurance policy for the people of Northern Ireland. Is that some type of joke?
No.
Formed in 2007, Jim. 8 years on, the DUP and Sinn Féin are very much still on top. What have you done over the last 7, 8 years?
I think we've done plenty. We have performed very well. And I think in Stormont, that is recognised what one single determined TUV voice can do. What have we done? We've produced Anzwell. We've produced the justice in terms of pensions for RUC widows. We have been that constant probing thorn in the flesh that I promised to be against DUP Sinn Féin misrule. And look at the state of our country. Look at the state of misgovernment. Look at the logjam that constantly afflicts government in Northern Ireland. You can't lay that at my door, but you can lay at my door constantly pointing that out.
If you're that cocky, why didn't you stand in this election? Because you chickened out.
No, I didn't chicken out. Two reasons why Jim Allister isn't standing. Because people recognise that I'm effective in Stormont. That's where we're building our power base from.
What did we get chinned the last time?
No, it's nothing to do with that. I've fought and lost elections before. That doesn't cause me to run away, I assure you. But people recognise my contribution is in Stormont. We're building that and we're building it towards next year. And secondly, it's important for me and TUV to demonstrate we're not what you would like to say, a one-man band. And therefore, I'm very happy that we have quality candidates. In fact,
you're the front man and you're not putting yourself up.
You're
the front man and you're not putting yourself up for election. What on earth does that say about you?
Nor is the leader of the DUP, nor is the leader of the Ulster Unionists, nor is the leader of Sinn Féin, nor is the leader of several other parties. In fact, I think there are only two party leaders, SDLP and the Greens, who are standing in this election. So it doesn't say anything unless it says that about us all. And I don't think it does. I'm demonstrating that we have a slate of capable candidates outside of Jim Allister who will collect votes beyond and above what I have been doing.
Don't you think, though, Jim, the fundamental problem you have is that people still want the peace process and you're trying to roll back the years. The majority, vast majority of people in Northern Ireland want the peace process.
I'm not trying to roll back anything. I'm not taking anyone back. I have no guns. I have no bombs. I have no bullets to take anyone back to the bad old days. If your suggestion to me that unless we continue to pervert democracy and guarantee Sinn Féin as of right, a place in government, then they might take us back to the bad old days. Then that says something about their commitment to democracy. But
they're
it says
because
nothing
because of their mandate,
me.
Jim.
They're there. Anyone can have a mandate to be in a legislative assembly or to be in a parliament. What you cannot in a democracy have is a mandate as of right to be in government. And that is the corruption at the heart of the democratic process in Northern Ireland. Take what's about to happen across the water. We're having an election. The people on the 7th of May are being afforded the opportunity, if they wish to take it, to change their government. Next year, if the Assembly lasts, we'll have an Assembly election in which the people of Northern Ireland will be denied the opportunity to change their government, denied the opportunity even to have an opposition. And it is that corruption of the very central core of democracy, which is the reason why government here is languishing in failure.
I've heard you go on and on about this mandatory coalition, the need for an assembly opposition. Do you really think you're going to get an old-style unionist majority rule back? You really
Have
think you're going to get that back?
I've never asked for that. I am very, very clear.
So you support power sharing.
Sorry, let me answer you. We are going to see, most probably, if it's a hung parliament, a government making inaction. What will happen? The parties who are elected, those of significant strength, will negotiate with each other. Those who can agree what they're going to do about the big issues and command the majority will form the government. Those who can't agree will form the opposition. I want the same system here. No party in Northern Ireland is big enough to form a government on its own. Therefore, there isn't going to be majority rule. But there is a need for a coalition of the willing, agreed what to do about welfare, agreed what to do about health, agreed what to do about education. Whoever they are, provided they can command the requisite majority, they govern. Those who can't agree, they form the opposition. And then you get a government that might work.
Do you not believe in a cross-community executive?
There's nothing in what I've said which would deny the opportunity for a cross-community executive. And indeed, if you want to underwrite it to make sure it is reflective of coming from both communities, then there is the option,
so
for example.
That,
there's the option, for example, of making its programme for government, its budget of that voluntary coalition, subject to a weighted majority vote,
of 60%. You opposed power sharing, Jim Allister, for a large part of your political career.
No, I have opposed mandatory, enforced coalition, which is a total antithesis of democracy.
What are you talking about this morning? What are you talking about, Mr. Allister?
Talking about democratising Stormont. I'm talking about getting something that works in place of that which is failing. That's what I'm talking about.
If you are saying that there has to be inbuilt power sharing, then there has to be a degree of that being mandatory. You're contradicting yourself.
No. Mandatory is that which says, no matter what the election result, all parties, as of right, are guaranteed places in government. That's what mandatory is. That's what isn't working. Voluntary coalition, perhaps underwritten by a weighted majority on key issues such as their programme for government, is saying...
A mandatory weighted majority?
No. Those who can agree what they're going to do about health, education, all those issues, and can command that requisite majority, they govern. Those who can't, whoever they are, they're the opposition. That's how you get a system that works. And that is why I am saying in this election how striking it would be if the Stormont system was applied to Westminster. On the 8th of May, you'd have Cameron, Miliband, Clegg, Sturgeon, all in Downing Street and no opposition. Now, how absurd would that be? How unworkable would that be? Just as unworkable as it is in Stormont. And that's why we are saying that this election is an opportunity, if there should be a hung parliament, to use the leverage to force the issue of democratising Stormont and giving to people of Northern Ireland the basic democratic right that everyone else possesses to change their government, to have an opposition and to have government that works instead of this constant lurching from crisis to crisis.
Well, let's actually see if there's any meat on your policies. You're a pro-austerity party, are you?
I'm pro the waste of money where it is being wasted, and there's plenty of examples of that in Northern Ireland, 165 million on useless north-south bodies, 16.5 million on almost 400 staff in the office of the Joint First Ministers when the Prime Minister's office has half of that.
We are talking about Westminster
out, it's all coming out of the same kitty. Yes, we are in a dire situation nationally where we are paying to pay off the interest in our country. We're paying £43 billion a year. We have a deficit of £1.6 trillion. We have national debt of something of the order of 82% of our GDP. Who in their right mind would say in those circumstances that you can just spend?
Yes, and that's why your manifesto talks about, quote, prudence when it comes to public finances. And you also say that there should be no tax rises. So if there are no tax rises, there's only one way that you reduce the deficit, and that's cuts. Who would you cut? Would you cut hospitals? Would you cut public finances? Where would you make the cuts?
No, I would cut the waste. And I would take the area I know best, and that's Northern Ireland. It possibly is a reflection of the rest of the United Kingdom as well, but it's particularly accentuated in Northern Ireland. And I would cut the waste out of what we've been, some of the things I've suggested. 165 million on north-south bodies that do what? Some of them don't even employ a single person in Northern Ireland. £5 million a year on wining and dining, as far as this executive's concerned.
£5 million a year is a drop in the ocean when you're talking about government budgets.
It's a drop in the ocean, but multiply it up.
What a cheap headline from you. What a cheap shot from you.
Oh, no, Stephen, you're the man to talk about cheap
shots. £5 million a year. You're talking about £5 million a year here in the context.
I'm demonstrating a cumulative total, and I'm saying that there are things to be cut. Look at the number of spin doctors in Stormont. 161 of them, and they still can't tell a good story because there's no good story to tell. 161 of them costing us millions of pounds a year.
Do you have any public-funded staff?
I have staff which comes through my secretarial alliance.
From the public
purse.
Which
I'm entitled to as a public representative.
Taxpayers pay
for it. As part of the mandate. Yes, they do. And I put it to good use. And I supplemented with my own resources to make sure the service is adequate.
So the staff you have are legitimate, and all of a sudden the staff other people have are wasting spin doctors. Come on.
No,
you're not better than that?
No, I haven't. I've said, why does this executive need 161 spin doctors? Now, anyone who asks themselves that question rationally and reasonably will conclude they don't. And that is but an illustration of the squander in government.
Well, how do you get this figure of 161? Who are you talking about? You're talking about officers there.
I'm talking about an answer to assembly questions which indicates that there are that number of people who can properly be called spin doctors.
Well, no. You can suggest you can call them spin doctors.
I can tell you where they are.
Are you talking about secretaries here and backup staff and administrative staff?
I can tell you there are 36 in OFM DFM. There are 5 in DFP. There are 7 in DETI.
Are you talking about press officers?
There are 9 in DHSS. I'm talking about press officers and their support staff. There are 9 in
DSD. Staff.
There are 20 in DOJ. There are 15 in DEL. Right. There are 5 in DRD. Do you want me to go on?
So it's not
totals 161.
It's not important for government and public offices to get their message out. Sure, it's not. That's not important.
That is important within reason, but it is unreasonable to squander money to the scale that is being squandered in this regard. And to anyone asked, your programme wouldn't be as busy as it is if they had a good message to tell. What they are trying to spin is the failure of Stormont, which I am constantly seeking to oppose and expose.
You said there that you contribute, that you top up, is that right, your office costs?
Yes.
By how much?
Well, this year I wrote a cheque for £4,500 to top up my office costs because Stormont allowance wasn't adequate to provide the service that I choose to provide.
Out of your Stormont salary, presumably?
Yes, out of my Stormont salary.
So you're contributing another £4,500?
Yes.
Why?
To keep the staff, because when I became...
Oh, you need staff now, do you?
Of course I need staff. I have 75,000 constituents. I have 2 offices open in my constituency. Of course I need staff to service their needs. And when the office expenses allowance doesn't meet those needs, I meet it out of my pocket. And are you now objecting to that?
Why are you against taking money out of the pocket of rich people in terms of higher taxes for them?
Well, I'm not. I haven't said that I'm against that at all. You'll not find that line in our manifesto.
Yes, I would. I can. I read it last night. Higher taxation plays no part in our thinking. Your manifesto.
Yes,
do you know what's in it?
Higher taxation plays no part in our thinking.
What
I'm rejecting is your pejorative interpretation of that to say that our manifesto says no more taxes on rich people.
No, you would not raise the tax for rich people.
It doesn't mention rich people.
Higher taxation plays no part in our thinking.
Yes, higher taxation for the man who drives the bus, for the man who earns a living, doing whatever he does, who contributes. I don't see the need, when we have government in a squander cycle, to raise his taxes.
So is that...
I think by keeping taxes at a competitive level, then you increase the prospects of getting people into work and you increase the return to those families and reduce the dependency of some families on the state. So it's a question of balance in terms of taxation.
So you've maybe
I certainly wouldn't justify in a circumstance where government is in charge of squandering money that simply we should feed the squander by increasing taxation.
So you've maybe just... forgotten to put into your manifesto that you wouldn't raise taxes for those high earners in this country. So let's just nail it now. Would you put up, if you had the fiscal power to do so, would you support putting up the top rate of tax?
I think a top rate of tax at 45% plus effectively another 10% on national insurance, producing more than half of what those people earn back to the state, is sufficient for a state to run itself.
So that's a no.
Yes.
Because Labour would put it up to 50%, wouldn't they?
I know they would. And they once put it up to 80%. And we know what the boom and bust that they delivered us then was. To get this country working, you have to incentivise people both at both ends.
The rich.
Incentivise them in terms of making sure it doesn't pay to stay on benefits and incentivising them to work harder and be more productive by making sure that what they earn, as much of it as possible, they can keep.
It doesn't pay to stay on benefits. You do realise, Jim, that there are some people on benefits who have no other choice.
There are absolutely some
people on benefits.
Be careful
that type of language, don't you?
Yes, there are absolutely some people on benefits, disabled folk and others, who have no other choice. But are you suggesting to me there's no one on benefits who couldn't and shouldn't be incentivised into work? I certainly think there are. And when you look at the scale of the fact of the numbers who are receiving average benefits, say, of £30,700 a year, some families, some of them deserving, because there may be a number of disabled children in those families, not quibbling about that at all, but I think there is merit in applying a benefits cap to those who are not in that category, who are living off the state, and that has become their culture and their way of life.
So how would you weed them out? Order,
by making sure that there was an incentive from capping benefits for those people so that they would begin to think, in fact, my life could be better if I went out to work.
No, but that's airy-fairy, isn't it? Because you've just
said it's not airy-fairy, because in GB, we are told tens of thousands of people have been incentivised back into work on foot of welfare reform. Now, those seem to be...
You support that type of welfare reform, do you?
I support welfare reform that incentivises people back into work.
Do you support reassessing everybody that's on benefits to make sure that they're entitled to them?
Well, that's like saying the corollary of that is that you don't assess them at all. You just give them a handout and never worry about assessing them. Of course the state, with public money, has to assess people in benefits.
I asked that question.
Of course it must. It would be utterly irresponsible not to assess people
I asked that question because on both Five Live and here, I've had calls from disabled people who say that, do you know what, they go through an assessment, it is clear that they have a lifelong disability, Jim, that isn't going to change,
yes,
and yet they're
I
continually put through these assessments.
Yes,
so the purpose of my question was, would you continue to assess those people?
I think there are people who obviously have lifelong disabilities, whose assessment isn't going to change other than maybe being worse. And therefore, it is foolish and unnecessary to constantly reassess those people. But that's not the category of person I'm talking about. I'm talking about the person who's capable of getting out of bed in the morning but chooses not to.
Do you think there are a significant proportion of those people, Jim?
I don't know what the proportion is, but I know this, that in Northern Ireland, we have the highest level of economically inactive in the whole United Kingdom. Now, I believe that that is reflective of a benefits culture in some parts of Northern Ireland, which has not been addressed and which Sinn Féin are determined won't be addressed. And that's why they have all their shopping list demands in relation to welfare reform. And I think welfare reform had the capacity to deal with some of that and to make a dent into that and to produce produce more people economically active in this country and contributing to the economy and therefore building and strengthening the economy.
You complain in your manifesto about major job losses and little evidence of executive action, and you're opposed to Stormont getting the power to cut corporation tax.
I certainly am, because who in their right mind would give this Stormont any powers? Who in their right mind would let this Stormont put their hand into anyone's pocket? But on corporation tax...
How about stopping just slagging them off and giving us your ideas for the economy? What would your big idea be for the economy?
No, I'm going to deal with your first question first, if I might. There's one certainty about corporation tax, and that is that at a stroke, it reduces in perpetuity the block grant by several hundred million pounds each year and every year. That's the certainty. On the other side, there's the hope, the expectation, the dream that it might produce more investment, that it might therefore produce more jobs.
God forbid Northern Ireland would think big, Jim.
I think we had a very clear litmus test of the likely impact of corporation tax cut in the JTI Gallagher's decision. Because the very month when it is postulated that corporation tax will be cut to 12.5% is the very month that JTI, one of our biggest manufacturers, is choosing, in spite of that, to leave Northern
What's
Ireland.
What's your big so idea for the economy, Mr. Alistair? What's your idea? Stop criticising others and give us your vision. What is your idea for the economy?
A skilled workforce. But what's this executive doing? Cutting.
No, you're under the executive
cutting
again.
The money. So that's because they're in charge.
So that's
I'm not
the totality.
In charge, Stephen.
That's the totality of the TUV policy. No. A skilled workforce.
No, if you allow me to speak, you'll get the totality
what
of the answer.
What is your big idea? What's your game changer? Give us your policy,
Jim. The first thing to do is to make sure to attract inward investment, that you have a skilled workforce.
Because nobody's
therefore
ever thought of a skilled workforce before.
Yes, but this executive is thinking of cutting the money to skills.
There you go again.
And that's what... Well, Stephen,
you're talking about them rather than yourselves.
They are the government.
But you're selling your vision this morning for how you would change things.
My vision is that we reverse that catastrophic approach and we invest in skills and that we create a skilled workforce which will be attractive to the inward investor. I'm also very mindful of the fact that most of our economy is made up of small, medium-sized businesses who are feeling the weight and the pressure of national insurance, of rates, and very little done to help them. The whole emphasis is on the glamour story of trying to get foreign direct investment when we so often ignore the indigenous companies which are struggling and which will be with us when the call centres have come and long since gone.
How much would you invest in a skilled workforce?
I would invest sufficient to ensure that we have the skills to meet the sales pitch that we're making for... I can't quantify that. I don't have the government books.
Right. You have no policy, do you?
No, I do have policy. And you can be as disparaging as you like,
No more
Mr.
disparaging
Nolan.
You are, Mr. Alistair, but every other political party in this country.
Maybe, Mr. Mullen, you have so many answers, you should have stood for election yourself. Maybe that would have been and brought your great expertise and salvation to the country.
You see, Jim, here's the score, right? The economy is one of the most fundamental issues in any democracy and one of the most important policy issues to scrutinise in this country and any other country. And when I ask you, the leader of the TUV, give us your detailed plan as to how you would turn around this economy, you've no figures, and all you have is two words, skilled workforce.
It's
pretty pathetic, isn't it?
No, Stephen, there are four pages, I think, in our manifesto dealing with this. Well, let's be very clear. Incentivising people into work, we've talked about.
That's airy-fairy.
No, that's not airy-fairy when you've got the highest economic inactivity rate in the whole
Who's
UK.
Who's opposed to
we
that,
have
though?
To do
Who's opposed to incentivising people into
Sinn
work?
Sinn Féin are the very people who have blocked welfare reform, which might have the capacity of incentivising people into work because they want to cocoon those on benefits. That's what you have to do. You then have to give an equal playing field to Northern Ireland in terms of foreign direct investment.
How would you do it?
I would make sure that InvestNI realise that Northern Ireland extends beyond Glengormley. Because here are some
How
facts.
How would you do that?
You like some facts. Here are some facts. In the last 5 years, my constituency of North Antrim had the grand total of 8 InvestNI organised foreign direct investment visits. The 4 Belfast constituencies, 739. Now, we need a level playing field of the promotion of Northern Ireland. People of North Antrim, people of South Antrim are just as important and elsewhere in terms of being promoted. So I would say to the chief executive of InvestNI, who is meant to be failing in this regard,
that he has to
get foreign direct investors to visit the entirety of Northern Ireland and not just to focus it on Belfast,
of course, those
which
foreign,
is what has been happening.
And of course, those foreign investors wouldn't be interested in a cut in corporation tax, sure they wouldn't. That wouldn't be attractive to them.
Well, we've already talked about JTI. It obviously wasn't attractive to them. And I think those who talk to people about foreign direct investment will soon realise that it's the level of wages in the economy, it's the skills of the economy, it's the durability of all of that, which is, in fact, more important to them.